let's get started.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Rolling with Legends. Here we are today. I'm Sandy Crenshaw.
And I'm just Crenshaw, but Michael Crenshaw.
Michael Crenshaw. And we are here today with one more legend, and that is Dan Shaw.
Number four.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
First thing is to talk a little bit about your relationship or lack of relationship, and lack is not a bad thing, but like gaming and what you like, where you are, what you've done, so that we can all get a little bit of context for you.
Okay. How do I make this answer not long?
It's only an hour podcast.
That's good. I mean, we might take up, you know, a quarter of the time with this. So I'm 37. So just to place that in terms of my age, right? So in back in around 1991, I was maybe 5 years old. And I'm going to try to make this not my life story. But we lived in this one bedroom apartment, and my stepbrother would come over every other weekend, and you know, he would bring this incredible gray box called the Super Nintendo, you know, the first time he plugged that into the TV and he fired up Super Mario World, you know, in 1991 or two or something like that, you know, my little five-year-old self was transfixed. I think I simply didn't know TV
in your life path.
Yes, absolutely. A serious one.
Yeah.
I don't think I knew a TV could do that, you know, that you could play a TV.
You had control now.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's really one of that's the element of control. It was an important thing to me at the time. Absolutely. It was. And so I was hooked, of course, you know, and so I still play today. I'm a very big fan of Legend of Zelda, you know, Mario, all the Bethesda games.
Oh, classic stuff. Yeah,
absolutely.
Did you do any tabletop role playing? Did you ever explore any of that at that time?
I did. Well, I was a little young at the time for that, but only a couple years later. So eventually I got into 40K and fantasy and I also did Magic the Gathering a lot at that time too. You know, I was one of the co-founders, I think. I hope I'm not stealing someone's thunder. I was one of the co-founders of the Magic the Gathering club in my high school. So, you know, just give you an idea.
Shout out to that. We'll shout out to that later below in the comments.
Yeah, in the 90s, early 90s, I played this game when I was a kid, and I actually had to go back and look it up. I said, what is this game called? I forget what it was called. It was called Weapons and Warriors. And it's not even really a tabletop game, but it was just these little medieval figurines, and you could set them up, and there were these orange cannonballs, and I think there was some kind of card or dice element to it. But, you know, I was a kid, and the thing I loved was being able to, you know, in an approved fashion, sort of launch marbles across a room.
Oh yeah, projectiles.
What kid absolutely love that?
I mean, it was amazing.
Make it smaller.
Yeah. I mean, it was wonderful. I mean, again, there was probably some kind of rules associated with the game, but I loved swords and magic, and of course, I wanted to, you know, launch orange cannonballs everywhere.
Can you still picture that, like launching orange cannonballs?
Absolutely. I mean, and as it is with the kid, like there's music we were listening to at the time. So, you know, a Pearl Jam track is going in the background as we're launching these cannonballs.
Absolutely. And that's very fitting. Yeah, that's very fitting.
Sets the scene for me.
Right.
Right.
So where are you now? Like, how would you define what you do, where you are, where your head is now in all of this gamer? Sort of creative space?
Mm. Do you mean as a gamer specifically?
Well, as a gamer, or, you know, how it bleeds out into everything else.
Mm. I mean, that's a really good question. I think that where I define myself now, I had a period in the 2010s where I didn't really play too much. I was trying to formulate life, what I was doing. And I think, as with many folks, the pandemic was an interesting kind of catalyst, and I have an essay that I was sort of working on about this, but there was a game that I was into in high school from the site Newgrounds, where it was called the game was called Use Box Men, and it was just this little platformer. It had a kind of self-awareness to it that cracked me up, and I just started playing that again, when the pandemic started, and I realized how much I had missed doing that, and how much I had missed that sense of emergent gameplay, the emergent narrative associated with gameplay. And that really is where a lot of what I do still bleeds through, where I want to make sure that when I'm working with students on their, I teach creative writing. And so when students come students come to me with stories about anything, whether it's literary fiction or science fiction, fantasy, the idea of having it be interesting, engaging, and believable, and where someone would do something that you might expect them to do versus what they might not ex you might not expect them to do, all those factors sort of kind of they come back to me, in those spaces. But
I
I
think that's
also
the joy of teaching, and I think that's part of the joy of teaching, of not being the teacher in the room. But
it's one of my
Well, let me ask you this. Now that you've unlocked a piece, I feel like I've just gotten another upgrade. Bing, haha, teaching. So, you're an educator, you're a professor. What kind of courses do you teach? I know Sandy mentioned she gave me a list one day while I was making breakfast of like a list of your courses, and I'm like, okay, I want to take that. Okay, I want to take that. Okay, I want to take that. Why can't I take that? So, yeah, please tell us in our audience. Share with some of the kind of the courses that you've been educating kids with.
Sure, definitely. So I have a pretty wide range, and that has a lot to do with my own career path through as an educator. I teach in the English department, and there's some typical courses that a lot of people teach, including composition. I teach literature courses. I teach Chinese literature in translation. But I teach Chinese literature, which has been fascinating and excellent. But most of the courses that I teach are in creative writing. So I teach introductory fiction and poetry. I teach a kind of intermediate workshop for poetry. I'm a poet primarily. And I also teach the capstone courses, so the senior thesis courses for students. And then I also teach a world building course. So it's a course specifically on world building. So.
That was the one that got me.
That's what we want to talk to you about today. Could you tell us a little bit about that world building course?
And can you
I
send
have
me a
some.
list of where I can sign up?
You
And thank
would be
you, Dan,
behind her.
for giving us a path to talk about what we want to talk about today.
Sure. Crenshaw, you would be behind the, whatever, 15 students on the wait list or something.
That's okay. I'll send them all out to get custard.
So tell us a little bit about this course.
Yeah, please.
Sure. I mean, it's called maybe perhaps uncreatively World Building Workshop, but it is pretty much exactly what it sounds like. It's 15 weeks of students coming together to write interesting pieces of fiction, and develop worlds around those pieces of fiction as kind of two simultaneous processes. And it's like a 15, I like to think of it, I don't use this term in the syllabus, but it's kind of like a boot camp where, there's exercises every week, there are responses for students every week where they're engaging in text. It's a fully online course, which is helpful as well. But it allows any student, whether they're a writer or a gamer or neither, to get started on that process. And we kind of run through, there's a specific track I like to follow where we start really large and then we begin to, we start with these kind of unknowables. So, like gods and cosmogonies, the origins of life, like what are the things that you, as the creator of the world or as the author, what are those, what are the things that whether your characters know them or not.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
then we narrow it down and we sort of l we layer those unknowables with what people would think, you know, so what's the history that people would say, despite the differences between what's actually true and what's actually not. Invented species, so you know, is it an elf or is it a person? You know, are all
Yeah.
species just anthropomorphized people, actually? Like, are all characters just anthropomorphized people, no matter who, what species they are? We talk about conlangs. That's an interesting week most of the
Yeah.
time. Magic, science and tech, law and politics. And we sort of drill down more and more to the points where you see some of these things being actualized in cultural ways. And the idea behind that is that it gives the students this huge, it's an overview of each of these things, but it gives them a kind of broad-based framework that they can use to do whatever they want to do with it. You know, we get students in computer science, psychology majors. Of course, we get creative writers, and like all of them are coming to this course with different reasons. Some of them are like, I want to make my own D&D world better. Some of them are like, I want to write this story. You know, but it's fascinating to see them all kind of interact, and they share their separate skills and kind of what they their shared interests and their skills together, despite their differences in their career paths and their majors. It's really a blast to teach. It's a blast.
So you had mentioned something. I led with something at the beginning of the episode, but you had mentioned something a bit like today. There's so much to talk about with every that list that you just gave us, but I'd really like today to kind of drill down a little bit into magic, because that is one of those distinctive, in some ways isolating sorts of pieces that we get whenever we're looking at a fantasy setting. You know, fantasy settings have magic.
Trope,
Yeah, it would be
right?
something like that.
Give me a trophy. What?
So can you tell us a little bit how do you come at that? What are the big concepts around magic and as you say, how it kind of manifests in a culture and how the culture is shaped by magic then?
Sure, yeah. I mean, one thing that strikes me, and I feel really, I like that's the central part of our course, really, is magic and technology. You know, those are the only two topics that take up 2 weeks each.
Yeah.
And with good reason. You know, I think that they're the central tropes, of course, right?
But if Arthur C. Clarke was in your class, he'd tell you that there's only one trope, though.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, Frank Herbert would say the same thing, I
Right,
think.
right, right.
And he's hip and hot right now. Oh, I know, of course. I was just accosted because I have not seen the new Dune yet. I know,
Oh,
it's a
dear.
gross oversight. I'm gonna get there.
You
But
will.
don't worry, the sand and the
We'll
spice will
talk.
still be there.
We'll talk.
And side note, we'll edit that out, but go ahead.
right.
I'm sorry, I
It's
didn't mean to do that to you. That
okay.
was my fault.
That's all right. No worries. So like the thing about magic and the reason I like magic and technology together is because they're so similar in terms of how they're often thought of as these kinds of systems, right?
Right, right.
But actually they're really diff they and they are similar, of course, but there's some interesting sort of nuances in how you can think of them differently. You know, when I think about the word technology, for example, I think about that as the way in which most people think about technology now. You know, like writing is a technology, of course, but that's not what people typically think about when they think about technology. Most of the time, I think when people think of that word, they're thinking of applied science. And so here is some scientific process or some science, something that we understand, a phenomenon we understand through the scientific method, and we've applied it to achieve this particular effect. So even in sci-fi, right, even depending on how hard or soft sci-fi is, there's typically some kind of logic behind it, right, where there
Right.
is, you know, this is
Laws.
science.
Yeah.
I'm
Right.
sorry.
It has to adhere to a set of laws.
Yeah, absolutely. Right,
Yeah.
right. And if it doesn't, there has to be some good reason why it doesn't. So,
Right.
you know, the Ansible is one of those interesting things where I think about that. That doesn't really
Right.
behave according to anything. And yet
Right.
she pulls it off, right? I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
But magic is self-referential. Technology is applied science, but magic is both the verb and the noun. It is both the thing that's applied and the thing that is resulted. And so it's a thing that is applied and it is the result, of course. When someone does magic, the effect is magic. And so there's a different degree of believability that's involved in that. And it's not always subject to the same kinds of laws that we think about with science and technology. But what's interesting is that it also can be narrativized in interesting ways that challenges that are culturally negotiated. So when we think about, for example, anything that is considered magic, and this is where magic and culture kind of they kind of collide, of course, right? But any kind of ritualistic practice, right, from any a wide range of cultures, right, whether it is saying a particular prayer over and over again as I'm a Catholic, so if I go to mass and we say a prayer, there's what it is, or if you or if there's a totally different cultural process that someone else might use to achieve a specific effect. It's not a coincidence that the folks who have control over those processes are also very frequently the folks who are in power. And so that really is where I like to think about magic as something that's culturally negotiated, because if you are in power, or if magic begets power, then you can also use magic to, you can systematize magic to create and maintain that status quo. So the most interesting stories that I read, or the most interesting scenarios that students will bring in their writing, for instance, is something that where you'll see magic carrying specific structures where there are rules attached to it, just like there are for anything else. But what happens when one of those rules is bent or broken? What happens when those rules are used in a cultural way to create stratifications in society, right?
Then you suddenly write 13 books in a series that get bigger and bigger each book, and then you unfortunately pass away, and someone picks it up and continues writing exactly what you just said. The whole story of that is about the
It's
idea of a
about power.
magic and then the breaking of magic because it's the wrong gender.
Yes, absolutely. It is. It is. Absolutely. It is. I mean, and that's one of the things that makes that so fascinating is that that's such a long process that is built, right? But like the world, it's only because that process was built for so long that it becomes interesting when it gets challenged and when it gets, when it gets, and that's what sustains it, right? It's the idea that the magic in and of itself is, it's not this thing that, what I said to a student the other day, something like, magic is power. And so it's more often that you'll find that there is a situation in which there's folks who are denied that power, right? If everyone has magic,
It's
it's
not
not
magic.
actually magic. It's just one more sort of, it's like
If
Dragon
we can
Ball
all
Z
pull
or
rabbits
something.
out of our hats, it's not a big deal.
You said
Right.
rabbits.
Oh, I did. Ding,
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 ding.
ding.
Oh, there's the prize. That's awesome. I love that. I love that idea because, myself as a GM and also as a consumer of science fiction and fantasy, I love the idea of there being the laws and being taught the laws in every world book you read. There's a slight variation on how they're like in this book, the oxygen is the currency that we're going to be playing with, and then here's the twist on that. So that's really interesting. And I love that you're opening students and people's eyes to that, to be able to look at that. That's really cool.
Is there a parallel or some sort of version of a parallel with technology? Because technology has those rules too. And in a lot, we think of technology as generally and very inaccurately, we think of technology as, well, everybody's got a cell phone now. Well, Honestly, no, not everybody has a cell
Right,
phone. Not
right.
everybody can afford a cell phone and that sort of thing. But I'm wondering if there are if there's some sort of overlap, some sort of interesting Venn diagram there.
There is, I think. And I think that there's a difference between how people use technology in a day-to-day basis, on a day-to-day basis. And I think that it's the difference between how people would use technology on a day-to-day basis and those who control the production of technology. And so even within that space, you can see that again, once people recognize something as power, it gets immediately co-opted and placed into a system where the already existing power structures are, they're using the power to maintain those structures. I think about, speaking of something that's kind of between magic and science, I think about the internet. And I am not I'm old enough that I do remember when the internet came around. And
Back in cobblestony times.
hey, stop that.
Right.
Not fair.
But I mean, that was basically magic, the idea of thinking about how in the world, thinking about what people did when, before thinking about the idea of a fax, versus, and even that was sort of magical, right? And I'm thinking of the idea of just sending a letter to someone, versus what we do now, it seems completely wild, right? But as soon as people, and I remember when the internet was new and I mean, new to the public, of course, but new in the sense that people could just explore, and there was a lot of freedom. And of course, there were probably dark things happening on the internet there too. But there was a lot more of, the internet is meant to be this communal space. It was, social media was meant to be this communal space, right? And now you see how, when people in power can control how those products are used. You begin to see how they also use those products and use those technologies to maintain the status quo. So now we have ads everywhere, right? Now, social media is kind of a complicated.
And think about this. One of the things that we were just talking about the other day, which I think is interesting, try to find a movie that you want to watch that you used to be able to find in your collection or go to the video store and rent. If it's not available somewhere, where is it? And how do you get access to it now?
Absolutely, absolutely.
I know this is a tangent completely, but software. You don't own software anymore. You don't have a CD of software anymore. You don't own anything now. We're now in a pay-per-moment society. We've crossed over.
Absolutely. Which is why I still have a huge tower of CDs over here.
10 terabyte media server with nothing but movies.
There we go. That's
That's it. That's
that.
it.
Dan, let me ask you this. This is really interesting. One of the things that, as for me, when I started really exploring world building at a young age, I got hungry for what made a world, in a sense of more than just from the point of view of a populace or a god or whatever, but like the geometry of reality in this world. How do you even back out to the geometry of reality to talk about what happens when masses collide and when a planet is cooling and something collides with it? How does a mountain range create a place that later populace will find a land to grow and a valley to prosper in? How do you get a student to be able to like zoom macro to micro back and forth? How do you get your brain rubber enough to do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's one of the principal challenges that students will find is, they're often in one space versus another. They either want to think about, I have this idea and I don't really care if it doesn't make sense, and this is what I want to do. And then you'll have other students who say, I have this huge idea that I want to start with, but I can't get started because it's so overwhelming to think about all of the options, right? And actually, one thing that benefits both of those groups is to start in the middle. It's to think about the fact that there's two different things that are going on simultaneously. Most of the time, we're building a world so that something interesting can happen there. And so when that's the case, I think about the idea of you don't necessarily you need enough of your world built and understood so that those interesting things can happen. But you want to make sure that you maintain enough flexibility in your thinking so that when you zoom out, if you need to, you can make changes. You can understand how there is a kind of causal relationship between, if these two, if tectonics exist in your world, for example, and those two plates collide and there's mountains there, yeah, that's going to create a structure where there's going to be running water. There's going to be, places where people could take shelter.
Exposed resources, right?
Right.
Right. Yep.
Right, exactly. There's an essay. I wish the name I don't have the name it's handy, unfortunately, but it's by Patrick Tomlinson, and it talks about this exact thing, the idea of kind of creating your world and looking at it as though you're sort of a real estate agent and saying like, oh, what neighborhood do we want to live in? That kind of thing, but
Right.
it's
Oh, we got a bunch of elves that like wood and need wood. We got some forest over here, right?
Yeah. And
Nice.
so you have something, someone like Frank Herbert, who is looking epic, for in my, medievalist sort of space, I come at it like the epic is I know how this is affecting political, geological, graphically affecting the whole world versus the romance about, and romance not, oh, I love you or anything like that. It's the romance about the one person or two people.
Yes.
So it's jumping in between those. And there's, we, as I was saying, you got Frank Herbert who's looking at the whole thing, who's looking at all of Arrakis when this is happening. But you've got someone else like C.S. Lewis in the Space Trilogy that Out of the Silent Planet is just about one tiny little thing, and the geography doesn't make sense, and the plants don't make sense, and nothing makes sense except it's a really cool story
Yes. Yeah.
about
Okay.
one person.
Yeah. And I also, if since you bring it up, since you started it,
Okay, I
I
started
did.
one.
But I think Herb, I think the thing that I think I love about Dune specifically is that Frank goes from the cosmology of the universe, the how the universe economically moves itself on a galactic scale because of the dying breath of a worm. The all the way from a galactic empire down to a single dying worm that leaves its husk in the sand that we scrape up and snort. I mean, that's brilliant.
It
You
is.
know, and
It's genius.
then you look at the Heechee series where you find a station full of spaceships with buttons and you don't know where they're going to go or how long you're going to be in transit or what's going to happen on the other end. And you close your eyes and the writer now is free to explore whatever realities are on the other side of that button.
Right. And
Which could be
that's,
anything. Yeah.
yeah, and I think that that's part of what makes those kinds of stories so interesting, right? The questions of scope. One thing I love about Herbert, and I like, Blake Crouch does this in the Wayward Pines series too. Spoiler, I guess. I
Right.
don't know if people need that spoiler or not, but the idea that, when you kick a storyline or you kick a history that far down, right? The idea of that being 10,000 years or 20,000 years into the future, in some ways it alleviates that responsibility of the causal relationships, right? You can say it doesn't really matter whether or not something is happening. And then you create a new causality. I think that there's where a lot of students or sort of newer writers can sometimes get hung up. It's the idea of, oh, I've set it this far into the future, so now I don't have to defend any decision. Well, no, you don't have to defend any decision that came before that, right? But now you're creating a new space where then there's a new series of causal relationships. But I mean,
And part of the interesting thing about that is thinking about magic and technology. Magic is always ancient, always ancient. But technology is always now.
right.
Even though we're, in our stories, we're using magic and technology in the now. And maybe that has something to do with power also, because technology, everybody pushes the buttons and all of that sort of thing, but magic is ancient and valued in a very different way.
And you touched on this earlier. It's cultural too. Like you mentioned, you do a lot of Chinese poetry. Asia has a whole different concept of dragons than the West does, just from a point of view. So that I just had to throw that in because, it's such a you have so many different cultures trying to explore that and having their own take on it.
Absolutely. And phoenixes too. They have a different
Right.
idea of a phoenix too.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, I think a Journey to the West is a great example. That's a in 1592, the authorship of it is contested. The idea of the characters in that story, so many of them sort of practice Taoist self-cultivation, and that allows them to assume all of these different shapes and forms, and they can grow huge, they can fly, but what's fascinating about it is that, the one, it's ancient, again, as we mentioned, and two, it's also indifferent. If you're a Taoist, you can be a good Taoist or a bad Taoist. And the good Taoists are sometimes fighting the bad Taoists in these epic battles, but they're both using the same thing, it's just fascinating to see how, that's it's and even there it's still not, there's plenty of people in those stories who don't have that magic and who are astounded when they see these fights happening. So you're still getting that same layer of some have it, some don't, but it just creates an interesting dynamic and conflict when there's two who use the same kind of magic but use it to different ends. And yeah, really, that's the thing between magic and technology, I think, is that because it's ancient, there's so many more narratives of control around it. When we think about technology, we often think about how little of it we actually control. Whereas I think a lot of the time we think about magic and how much of it we control. It's really fascinating.
So, well, we're coming to like a point where there's just enough
Don't say it.
wonderful stuff out there where we're gonna ask our last question that we've been asking everybody, Dan. So, what two
Or
or
three.
three takeaways do you have for GMs, players, writers, or Crenshaw's pointing to himself right now?
Just
What
for me.
just
This is just for me. Our audience can listen in, but Dan, tell me how to become a better GM with world building, please.
I think if there are two pieces, there's sort of linked pieces of advice, I think, which is that a lot of GMs do this anyway, of course, but I think it's prioritizing story over outcome, which sounds bizarre because you would also think about the outcome as part of the story, but I actually mean that down to the decision level. Thinking about prioritizing what makes story really interesting, what makes worlds interesting is that they are stories, actually, right? Like, even our own world is built through stories, if we think about it that way. And so this is how we explain the unexplainable. But if the idea of the outcome is either too predetermined, or if it is something that is too where the GM is too invested in a particular outcome versus another, it can often create conflicts in the story. And I always think to students when they come up and they say, like, how do I get started in on doing this? I often think to ask them, who lives here and what do they want and why can't they get it? It's like the basic stuff about storytelling. But I think related to that is the idea of thinking about rules. We've talked a lot about like laws and rules in magic. And I mean, I actually think rules are great because they're both a vehicle through which you can recognize limitations and risks associated with magic or with anything related to world building. And in that way it can create useful constraints. When I think about freedom, it can all, rule can create freedom and it can also kind of stifle it. And I think about, for example, in D&D, when there are rules associated with with spells, right? The randomness of a D20, right? Like these things actually help players believe in the realism of something, right? So the rules are actually there as a mechanism for us to believe. And if the rules aren't serving that purpose, it actually can stifle that feeling for us.
It's casting a spell both ways. It's casting a spell within the game, but it's also casting a spell of believability for us with connection to the dice. That is beautiful and brilliant. I've never saw it that way, but that's really interesting, and that's really one of the reasons why I broke away and moved into homebrews. But that's a whole nother podcast.
I would like
Wow. Wow, Dan, that's
that
really amazing. Thank you. That's really interesting. Because you know, that's one of the things that as a GM, I am aware of. I'm taking the temperature of every player at the table at every second of every moment, seeing where their enjoyment level is and what do I have to do to adjust my game to bring them back into that pleasure space. And a lot of times it's going, okay, make a brain power roll. Just to take them out of what they're doing, to go, oh, I have to do something with my character now. And instantly you see a change. And I never understood that. And you just put it into perfect, understandable technology for me. You just de-magicified that. Thank you.
I appreciate
Wow.
it.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, we talk about like railroading. No railroading. Because railroading, in this sense, then it breaks the spell.
If you had asked me when I was five why I was interested in games, I wouldn't have been able to tell you. And we mentioned this at the outset, but one of the things that is so great about games is that there's something that you can, in theory, you can control the outcome of, and you're a participant in the outcome in this way that life doesn't always allow. And I think rules, if they help players believe that, and they if rules give them constraints but also control, I think that those two things together really do help players engage and believe, and they become invested when they know that they have both of those elements associated with rules. But
So, Dan, thank you so very much for joining us today. This was a whole lot of fun. I could feel Crenshaw's brain overloading right now.
wanted to say that this is exactly why this podcast is here, because this is the kind of conversations and why we look for people like you, because you're a legend, Dan, because you are able to see things from that point of view and be able to teach and educate us with that and help us become better storytellers, better narratives and better world building.
I appreciate the work you're doing on this as well. So thank you. I think it's really great. It's really excellent.
Dear listeners, thank you so much for sticking with us. And
With that,
with that, please smash or like or comment or subscribe, whatever you do in the platform you listen to. We'd love to hear from you. And we will see you next time.
and thank you again, Dan, for joining us on Rolling with Legends.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Let's go.